James Earl Carter Jr., better known as Jimmy Carter, was the 39th President of the United States, serving from January of 1977 to January of 1981. In February 2023, it was announced that following various stays in hospital, the 98-year-old Carter had decided to spend his remaining time at home with his family to receive hospice care instead of additional medical intervention. It seemed like only a matter of weeks before his passing, but more than a year later, he's still breaking records as the oldest former U.S. president, and for the longest post-presidency in U.S. history. This is especially remarkable considering that, in the early 1950s, during his time with the U.S. Navy Submarine Service, he personally went into a crippled submarine reactor, which was experiencing a partial meltdown, in order to shut it down. Carter's presidency from 1977 to 1981 is remembered for the difficulties he faced. These were years of high oil prices, high inflation, the Iranian Revolution and subsequent Iran hostage crisis, and the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. Today, he is perhaps better remembered for his decades of post-presidency humanitarian work. But because this is the Formosa Files podcast, we're going to focus on what Carter himself called the most important decision he ever made, switching diplomatic recognition from Taipei to Beijing.
The Taiwan History Podcast, Formosa Files, is made possible through the generous sponsorship of the Frank C. Chen Foundation. Formosa Files.
This was announced on the 15th of December and carried out just over 2 weeks later on January 1st, 1979. Pretty quick. And it was a shock for the world and, of course, for Taiwan. But in many ways, not a shock, because Richard Nixon had wanted to do this during his second term. So, John, what elements were behind the timing of this normalization of relations with Beijing?
Well, these delicate diplomatic matters take time. So things started back in Carter's first year of his presidency. He sent his Secretary of State, Cyrus Vance, to Beijing. And Vance told the Chinese that the U.S. wanted to keep an official U.S. consulate on Taiwan while establishing formal relations with the PRC.
Ah, so the U.S. wanted to have its cake and eat it too, eh? I'm sure the Chinese rejected that very quickly.
Indeed. Are you familiar with the name Brzezinski?
Yes. It's a memorably difficult name to say. Zbigniew Brzezinski, a name reflecting the fact that he was born in Poland. He was Carter's national security advisor, a position lower than a secretary of state. But as was the case with Kissinger, sometimes these advisors can override their boss.
Right, you know where I'm going. After Secretary of State Vance's failed trip to China, this Brzezinski asked President Carter for an opportunity to try negotiating. Vance objected, but the national security advisor went ahead with a trip to Beijing. This was in May 1978. The Americans would switch diplomatic relations, but still sell weapons to Taipei. The Chinese said that they would protest, of course, but it was all right. I think the sweetener was the Americans promising the Chinese access to previously withheld U.S. technology and getting them advanced weapons from European allies.
So, Brzezinski takes control of the steering wheel, and Vance is kind of just pushed to the side. There's more negotiation, and everything wrapped up December 13th, with the announcement scheduled for just 2 days later. That is very hasty.
Indeed. If we go back to the friction between the more hawkish national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, and this Cyrus Vance was focused on reducing the Cold War arms race. He was wanting to push some limitation talks called a SALT II agreement with the Soviet Union. But for him, Vance, this arms reduction was his top foreign policy priority. But Brzezinski wanted a tougher policy against the Soviets,
which is why he was so keen to normalize relations with the PRC. But because of these upcoming arms reduction talks, this SALT II agreement, the timing of the announcement of switching relations was very sensitive.
Right. Vance was going to have talks with the Soviets in December this month. He didn't want news to break before that. but Brzezinski insisted that the announcement be on December 15th. I wonder if this was deliberate sabotage of showing the Soviets, hey, U.S. relations with China are more important than with you guys.
President Carter did go ahead and announce the normalization agreement with China on the 15th of December, 1978. A week later in Geneva, just as Vance had predicted to the president, the Soviets erupted in anger over the timing of the announcement, and as a result, Vance could not complete those SALT II limiting arms agreements with the Soviets. And there was also an anticipated Carter-Brezhnev summit meeting, and that had to be postponed.
The early announcement also made Congress angry. They should have been consulted.
And Taiwan didn't get much warning either. There's even a memoir called The Lady and the Tiger by Patricia Linder, the wife of the top U.S. military man in Taiwan at the time. She gives a very dramatic picture of events at this time.
It's the evening of December 15th, 1978. The time difference with the U.S. means it's very early in the morning in Washington. Mrs. Linda is with Chinese and American friends at the annual Chamber of Commerce Christmas party. There's music and dancing, and she's dancing with the U.S. Ambassador Leonard Unger. They're dancing and making small talk when she notices a Marine uniform standing in the distance, looking for someone. The Marine spots the ambassador, doesn't wait for the dance to finish, but comes up behind Unger, taps the ambassador's shoulder, leans forward and whispers into his ear.
The party is over, literally and figuratively. The ambassador has just received notice of Carter's decision. Ambassador Unger had arrived in Taiwan in late May 1974. He'd had a long diplomatic career in Europe, Southeast Asia, and this posting in Taiwan was to be his last one before retirement. So, this poor guy, one of his last duties is to find and inform President Zhang Jingguo of this very bad news.
Right, so he's got to go do that right now. And I don't know why it took so long to track Zhang Jingguo down at his residence. But yeah, by the time they'd found him and convinced his aides to wake him up, it was around 2 a.m. and Unger passed on Carter's message.
So Patricia Linder, the person we were talking about who wrote that memoir, she wrote that her first thought was for the people of Formosa. She writes, quote, "They were defenseless, and so were we, not only from an invasion, but also from the people themselves. There was bound to be resentment and rage that this loyal ally of the United States was so unceremoniously booted out. For 30 years, they trained and kept their army ready to assist us in any theater of war. And we, as part of the agreement, provided the shield that protected them and allowed them a normal way of life. Now it was gone, and I knew they felt adrift and angry."
The next day, the radio was on. I assume this would be the Armed Forces radio. And in the middle of Bing Crosby's White Christmas, Linda says, the station abruptly went off the air. A man's voice came on and announced, first in Chinese, then in English, that the mutual defense treaty with the United States had been broken and all diplomatic relations had ceased.
Yes, that would be the Armed Forces Radio, which very soon after that would become ICRT, the only English radio station in Taiwan. But Patricia, in her memoir, she writes something quite powerful. She says, for the first time in my life, I was ashamed of my country.
The Americans had to go into a kind of quarantine. Families were told to stay inside their homes. The children were pulled out of school. Everything stopped.
Following the announcement, President Carter needed to send a high-level U.S. representative to Taiwan to put as good a face as possible on the U.S. termination of official relations and the pullout of American staff from the island. So, who to send? Not surprisingly, the top people in the Carter administration were not exactly fighting each other for the honor of coming here. 6 days, though, after the normalization announcement, Carter announced that the Deputy Secretary of State, Warren Christopher, would leave for Taiwan on Christmas Day. Merry Christmas.
He wasn't looking forward to the trip. The decision to switch diplomatic recognition was bad enough, but the way it had been done made things worse. In his memoir, Warren Christopher says he expected he was in for, quote-unquote, non-stop verbal abuse, but Quoting him again, he says, "As things played out, I undershot the mark."
Yeah, things were pretty bad from the moment he stepped off the plane. He had an unfriendly reception at Taipei Airport from Frederick Chen, Taiwan's vice foreign minister. After some angry words, the vice foreign minister said rather ominously that Christopher would, during his stay, quote, "gain a clear understanding of the position of the government and the feelings of the people."
Not very friendly.
No. Christopher actually wrote that it was one of the most hostile official welcomes ever extended to a visiting official.
But things were only going to get worse. He got into a U.S. embassy car, and inside was U.S. Ambassador Leonard Unger. They headed to a hotel. They didn't get far, though, just outside the airport and onto the road, and
Yeah, and this is Songshan Airport in Taipei City. Not CKS Airport, which has now been renamed Taoyuan International Airport. Taoyuan International Airport, or at that time CKS Airport, it would open in a couple of months. So he flew into downtown Taipei.
Yes. So out the airport area and they drive straight into urban Taipei. The road is lined with, quote, "an angry, jarring mob of about 20,000 people. As we move through the middle of the crowd, eggs and ripe tomatoes begin to fly at us from both sides of the road. Following these relatively benign missiles came cans and rocks encased in mud. Within 3 or 4 minutes, every window in the car was shattered. Leonard Unger's glasses were broken, and we were both nursing cuts from flying glass."
Wow. So, as the cars, this procession of them, inched down the road, Christopher says the protesters moved in and surrounded them. Somehow, he writes, bamboo poles were jammed through the car's broken windows, forcing Unger and me to perform a panicked limbo dance in the back seat. Next, demonstrators jumped on the bumpers and fenders, violently rocking the vehicle while hands grabbed at us through the windows, attempting to pull us into the mob.
Wow. They must have been wondering, where the heck are the police? I mean, hey, isn't this a tightly controlled police state?
Yeah, there were police, but Christopher says that they, quote, "did nothing more than stand quietly, staring impassively at us and the surrounding chaos."
I think it took nearly an hour for them to get through a short section of the city and then onto an expressway, finally free of the crowd. They decided, however, not to head for the scheduled hotel. There would surely be another demonstration there. Instead, they headed to the ambassador's summer house up in the hills above Taipei, up on Yangmingshan.
So at the ambassador's place, there was a telephone conversation with President Carter and Secretary of State Vance. Christopher should come home, they said, immediately if he felt he was in personal danger. And if he'd been given that option a little earlier, he probably would have taken it. But he says, quote, "over a stabilizing scotch and a pleasant house overlooking the city, the situation seemed a bit more manageable."
There must have been some furious calls back and forth from Washington and Taipei that night. Promises from the authorities for protection, I assume. And Christopher went ahead with his meeting the next morning with Jiang Jingguo, president of the ROC.
Meeting just the next morning, Christopher must have been still rather shaken and angry. And yeah, when they came face to face, Christopher expressed himself. He said, he recounted in detail the actions of the mob, and then he talked about, it's very curious, the inaction of the police.
Yeah, I think anyone would put two and two together and come up with the answer that the Taiwanese government, if not behind the protest, the violent reception, were at least purposely not stopping it, right?
Yeah, and Christopher says, quote, that CCK fidgeted, seeming to know the story before I told it. But finally, he said he would ensure our safety. Christopher then asks for the name of the security chief, so he'll have someone to blame and name if this promise is broken. And he writes, quote, "I was stunned when his translator refused to translate my question and instead began reciting a demand from Jiang that the United States reconsider the decision to normalize relations with China."
Wow. Yeah, this is not going well, is it?
No.
Carter's announcement was mishandled, but now CCK, just making matters worse. Christopher stated firmly that the U.S. decision was final, It's not going to be reconsidered. They're not going to change it. However, to placate him, he said the US-ROC relationship could continue on an unofficial basis as other countries were handling this diplomatic problem.
So Christopher stayed on for a second day in Taipei to explain to officials at lower levels of Taiwan's government how this new unofficial relationship would work through an American Institute on Taiwan, which we now call AIT, right? American Institute, staffed by former U.S. diplomats.
There was pushback. The ROC officials only wanted proper government-to-government relations. And Christopher, well, he didn't attend a farewell dinner. He left the country with very little warning.
I don't blame him. I'm sure he was thinking, let's skip any possible further demonstrations.
Yeah, and he says it was, quote, on such short notice that some of my party had to leave personal belongings in the hotel.
Rather in a hurry to leave Taiwan, and I would guess that he was glad to leave as well.
Yeah, the return to the United States did not end Warren Christopher's involvement with Taiwan, though. Once back in Washington, he was assigned as point man in seeking congressional enactment of the Taiwan Relations Act, this measure that was going to be the structure for continuing ties, unofficial ties between the U.S. and Taiwan.
Christopher says that it was, quote, a thankless task because congressional supporters of Taiwan were outraged by the normalization agreement and by the failure to consult with them in advance, end quote. I wonder if there was any lasting damage in this new Taiwan-America relationship from Warren Christopher having such a tough time being the bad guy and having to go make the announcement.
Well, not immediately, but fast forward, Christopher would be Secretary of State for Clinton's first term. So that's 93 to 97. And that's when human rights were delinked from trade issues, and we really see the rise of modern China. So maybe.
And of course, it's not surprising to hear that there was despair in Taiwan over all of this. Taiwan was afraid the PRC would invade. If nothing else, there was uncertainty. But ROC supporters in the United States were not going to abandon their ally. And in April, the U.S. Congress enacted the Taiwan Relations Act, authorizing de facto relations through the American Institute of Taiwan, and also promises, but not guarantees, to defend Taiwan.
And in the months between the announcement of switching ties and this new Taiwan Relations Act, there was a lot of packing to do, finding new schools for kids. You had to find new owners for your pets, files to shred, I guess, flags to take down. Patricia Linder's husband, as the last commander of the U.S. Taiwan Defense Command, he had to oversee the termination of the military assets on Taiwan. His work was done, and he departed Taiwan on April 28, 1979.
I believe it was just like 24 hours or so later that ICRT came to life. Anyway, John, do you remember that Formosa Files versus ChatGPT episode we did?
Yes, fondly. We spanked it.
Yes. Among the AI's many mistakes was claiming that Jimmy Carter visited Taiwan in 1994. That was wrong, but Carter did actually come here, but it was in 1999, 2 decades after his big decision to normalize relations with Beijing.
Yes, this was a 3-day visit, part of a wider trip to Asia, to the Philippines and Indonesia. While Carter was here, he visited the National Palace Museum. He toured the Hsinchu Science Park. That's where the computer chips are made. He met with top officials, President Li Denghui, and he gave a major speech titled The Greatest Challenge of the Next Millennium. The greatest challenge, he thought, was the growing gap between the rich and poor people of the world. And yeah, there was a press conference as well.
Mm-hmm. It's a brave visit, and as expected, it was not all plain sailing. Carter did get a good reception from President Li Denghui, who praised him, praised Carter profusely for his post-presidential work, for his very practical charity efforts, such as building homes for the poor, as well as for promoting peace and human rights. President Li told Carter, quote, "Your philosophy of life has earned you the reputation of best ex-president of the United States. And then Lee Teng-hui said that Carter's retirement was a model that he himself would like to follow.
This is 1999, so Lee Teng-hui has less than a year in office before his own retirement, then aged 76, I think, so a year older than Carter.
Carter, in return, had some praise for President Lee Teng-hui. Carter said, quote, "Taiwan has made itself a model for many other countries by its development, in which the outstanding leadership of President Lee has played a significant role."
But others had something else to say. After his speech and at the press conference, there were some sharp questions.
Yeah, get this. At the end of his talk, Mr. Carter, former President Carter, was confronted by none other than Annette Liu, a member of the opposition Democratic Progressive Party and very soon to be vice president. She said she'd been longing for this moment for 20 years. Mr. Carter's decision to break diplomatic ties with Taiwan, she said, led to the cancellation of an election. And the fallout for this was protests and things escalating to the Formosa incident, after which many opposition activists were arrested and sentenced to prison, slowing Taiwan's democratization.
This seems like a stretch. You can hardly blame Carter for the KMT canceling some elections and the subsequent imprisonment of opposition activists and leaders.
Yeah, I would agree. But Annette Liu did not, and she wanted an apology. Mr. Carter, however, declined to apologize. He said, quote, "The decision made in 1978 was a right one." And he also said, "I think although the decision was not the cause of or the primary reason for the progress among the people of Taiwan, it was certainly a factor."
Yeah, he thought what he'd done was not a mistake and no need for an apology. He was proud of it. He thought transferring U.S. recognition to Beijing was, as you said earlier, the biggest decision of his life, and believed it had made Asia safer and also helped transform Taiwan into an affluent democratic society. That's the way things played out, but who knows? Events could have unfolded differently.
Actually, Taiwan's foreign minister, Mr. Jason Hu, and if you know that name, it's because he was mayor of Taichung and very frequently on the news, but at the time he was foreign minister, he was critical of Carter's comments. He said that events might actually have turned out more damaging. Mr. Hu said, quote, "The severance of relations could have devastated us." And he said, "Taiwan's democratic, political, and economic achievements are the fruits of our own efforts," end quote.
Yeah, Carter faced accusations of having been soft on Beijing and selling out Taiwan. But to this, he replied that he had pushed PRC leader Deng Xiaoping to accept American demands to keep supplying arms to Taiwan. And Carter said the Taiwan Relations Act ensured continued protection.
There was blowback on this too, though. During his visit here, Carter took credit for personally drafting the Taiwan Relations Act. But as some Taiwanese officials and other commentators pointed out, this was a bit of a misremembering of history. It was the U.S. Congress that was responsible for drafting the Taiwan Relations Act, not the Carter White House.
Although Jimmy Carter takes quite a bit of blame for switching relations, I think it's hard to criticize him, really. It could have been done better, but it was just a matter of time, wasn't it? His switching relations fitted in with his other efforts. He gave Panama Canal back to Panama. It's very easy to be the fat guy on the sidelines shouting at the people on the field, but it's quite different to be in the arena yourself. If we go back to the 1970s, Taiwan was an authoritarian nation, and it was obvious that the nationalists weren't going back to China. Mao's decades-long rule had ended and there was promise, so things maybe didn't work out the way people hoped, but you can understand the promise and the decisions they made.
Yeah, you know, in America, Carter is still considered somewhat controversial. The conservatives obviously are not so fond of his presidency, and progressives see some good in it, but pretty much everyone in the U.S., as far as I understand, are in awe of what he did after leaving the White House. This guy is just an incredible human being. We will post lots of photos of various meetings and things related to the change of relations on our website, formosafiles.com. Thanks for listening. I'm Eric Michael Smith.
I'm John Ross.